I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Of course you are. Thank you for being here with me. I can feel you all. And it feels good that we're all joining together to talk about my favorite subject, food. And sometimes it's a happy story. Sometimes it's a not so happy story. Sometimes it's a delicious story. Interesting all the time, I think, anyway. And one of the things that I'm so excited about is we've been transcribing all of these shows, and I am so grateful for the volunteers who have been doing these transcriptions. And what's fun is I've been learning things from them as well as them learning from the programs. It's been a real give and take and give all around. But the great news is that we are totally current with 2013. We are almost all finished with 2012 interviews, and we'll go back for the few years before that. And it'll all be there for you for free at responsibleeatingandliving.com to listen to or read your choice. Lots of wonderful information there. And thank you for supporting it and listening. And what else can I tell you about responsibleeatingandliving.com? That's my nonprofit. And from time to time, I go and I try and make the website a little bit easier to navigate. And you might go to the It's All About Food tab. You can see what guests are coming up. You can see everyone that's been on the show, a guest interview index in alphabetical order by first name. And then all the archives from 2013, 2012, 2011, 2009, 2010. Lots of good things there. Now, let's get to the delicious part of the program, please. We are going to be speaking with someone who's already been on the show, and I'm looking forward to having her back. Lori Sadowski is the author of Allergy-Free Cook Bakes Cakes and Cookies. She's the author of the Allergy-Free Cook Bakes Breads, an active food writer with 2 degrees in music education and musicology, and a certified personal trainer specialist and nutrition and wellness specialist. Welcome to It's All About Food, Lori.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, how are you doing today?
I am pretty good, thanks. How are you?
Good. So I'm looking forward to speaking with you in the next 30 minutes or so. And there's a lot of good things to talk about. But first, let's talk about that evil wheat a little bit. I've read so many different things about wheat, and there's more and more information about wheat in the news and in magazines and in medical journals because so many people are having issues with wheat. But some of the things that have been surprising me are how much wheat we've actually eaten. There were times, I think in the early 19th century here in the United States, where a lot of people got about 30% of their calories from bread.
Yeah, that's not surprising.
That's huge.
Yeah.
And then also somebody was connecting the dots recently where because of global warming, if you want to call it that, there are all kinds of weather issues that are affecting wheat crops. And you have people in Egypt, for example, many of them who still eat 30% of their calories from wheat.
Yeah.
And they were connecting the dots saying that maybe some of the turmoil in the Middle East is due to these people who are starving because the cost of wheat has gone up because of global warming and droughts, and they spend like 35% of their income is on food. So there's all kinds of interesting stories connected with wheat.
Yeah, it definitely has a big connection across the board, not just with celiac disease or special diets.
But the amazing, it just boggles my mind because so many people have lived on it and so much of it, and now it's becoming problematic.
Right.
Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that, like, a big issue with it becoming more of an issue is that with the, with, like, genetically modified crops and things like that, and in an area where we do rely on a lot of wheat consumption in general because it might be cheaper or, you know, other grains aren't as, I don't even want to use the word popular, but, I mean, in the last year, we've obviously heard a lot more about, say, quinoa, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Quinoa is a very popular grain. But, I mean, it's definitely much cheaper to rely on something like corn or wheat and then when they're genetically modified crops. We're just eating too much of them because they're often put in other ingredients or other products as well. You can see corn as a filler in everything,
right. Everything
from, you know, candy to a loaf of bread that should be maybe even whole wheat. So it's everywhere and it's cheap. So that's why it's in everything.
Yeah, it's artificially cheap. It may not really be cheap, but we see it as cheap because
the government
supports those crops. And you're probably familiar, there's this one book that's been on the bestseller list for a while now, Wheat Belly.
Yes, I am familiar with it.
And I had interviewed Dr. Davis on this show, and there were parts of the book that I liked a lot and parts I didn't like at all. but he did bring up some interesting things about the history of wheat. I personally didn't care for what he promoted as a diet, and I also don't believe that you can lose dramatic amounts of weight just by eliminating wheat from your diet. That was kind of a big, lofty claim. But very interesting about the history and how wheat has been developed over thousands of years.
Right, yeah. I know, similarly, I know a lot of people who follow a paleo type of diet where even if, I mean, personally, I'm a vegan, but even...
Yay!
Their points, though, on wheat consumption, I think are good points. I'm not saying that everyone needs to give up wheat or exactly what you said in the way of, it's certainly not as a weight loss diet, but if people eat, it's just like we wouldn't just eat apples all day, you know, like we have to vary how much we're eating. We wouldn't eat 30% of our diet of apples, just like we shouldn't eat 30% of our diet of one single grain.
Yeah. I think a lot of people attribute weight loss sometimes to a particular diet, but most of it is just when they're trying to follow a diet, for example, just the fact that they're concentrating on what they're eating, all of a sudden when they're paying attention, they can lose weight just because they're making some sensible choices because they're thinking about what they're eating.
Yes, I agree with that very much. I think that when people say might go on a low-carb diet, I think that gluten-free often gets confused with the words low-carb because they think that they're just cutting out grains, which, I mean, a grain-free diet perhaps, but not wheat or gluten-free because there's so many other grains, even if they're, you know, what they refer to as pseudo-grains like quinoa or millet or something like that, there's still these higher carbohydrate ingredients that people should be including in their diet. But when but people are often also saying, well, if I feel much better because I cut out bread and pasta and I'm gluten-free, but they also might not be looking at the amount of grains that they're eating that are hidden, or they might have chose to go on a low-carb diet, therefore lost weight because they're not eating, they're eliminating a full food group.
Yep. People really don't know what's in their food unless they're really, really paying attention. And sometimes it takes a lot of attention, even if you're reading ingredients. You may not be sure where they come from or what they might be cross-contaminated with. It gets really complicated.
Yeah, it can certainly be exhausting.
Yeah. Okay. So that's wheat. Before we get into your new book, we'll get to that soon enough. I wanted to mention that I have your old book about baking bread, and it's not that old. What, did it come out a year ago?
Yeah, about a year ago, a little bit more than a year.
Yeah, so I hadn't used it very much when we had talked about it, and I've got probably a gazillion cookbooks, mostly because I talk to a lot of cookbook authors on this show.
Right.
And I don't really get to know many cookbooks very well, and I also just like to make up stuff in the kitchen. But, you know, occasionally something leads me to a book or I want to compare notes with a bunch of different cookbooks. And anyway, short story long, I got into your bread baking book and it is excellent.
Thank you.
Really. So I've been looking in different gluten-free baking books and I want to give you an A+.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, to start with, that book and this new one are relatively light and thin, but they're not light and thin on information.
Thank you. I appreciate that so much, seriously.
Now, I have to share one of the secret ingredients in some of your recipes, and it's like 2 tablespoons of ground almonds does amazing things to the flavor of pizza crust or bread rolls. Amazing.
Well, I appreciate you hunting down those those secrets. But they do. They add a nice, pleasant flavor and some nice texture as well. Without, you know, having to use too much, you can easily grind that yourself. You know, you don't have to buy a bag of almond flour or something. So I try to make the recipes as accessible as possible to everyone.
Well, I'm okay. A lot of people tell me they can't be like me, and I'm thinking, why not? But I like to spend time in the kitchen, and I haven't started grinding my own grains yet, but I like to make a lot of things from as whole or from the essential ingredients as possible. And so one of the things I have is a coffee bean grinder that I use regularly for flax seeds, occasionally for spices, and to grind those 2 tablespoons of almonds whenever I'm making one of your recipes. And I think it's important because nuts and seeds, for example, can go rancid very quickly.
Right, that's very true. A lot of people don't know that, especially even with gluten-free flours, that a lot of them should be stored in the fridge or the freezer if you don't have the room in the fridge. But, yeah, that can all, especially when they're already ground, that's a big, big thing to know.
Yeah, so I don't want to buy almond meal.
Right.
And I want to make it up quick, and it's really not that difficult to do that. And I've made the pizza crust, and I've used Miyoko Shinner's recipe for almond mozzarella cheese.
Oh, yeah, she has some pretty amazing recipes in that book.
And it's amazing with a homemade delicious tomato sauce. It's pizza.
Yes.
That
for sure.
Pizza crust tastes like real pizza crust.
Thank you.
Yeah, anyway.
No, so, I really appreciate it. It's really, really kind of you.
But I'm very excited about it because I'm sincere. This is really good stuff. Now, let's just talk a minute about what's available in the stores today. There are so many products now for people that have gluten intolerance. I remember when I was young in the days of Betty Crocker and Duncan Hine mixes, I never understood why anyone would want to buy a mix, okay? That's just me. But if you read the ingredients on a mix, what is it? It's flour.
Pretty basic.
I mean, it's basic. It's flour. It's baking powder, sugar. I mean, not much else.
Yeah, usually that's it. Maybe a pinch of salt, and then just gives you the guidelines of what to add. It's pretty brainless.
And you can't do that yourself. I mean, I just don't get it. Okay, that's just me. But then you add another level of complexity when it's gluten-free.
Right, yes, of course.
But there are still gluten-free mixes out there, and I've tried a few, and for my palate, they're usually too sweet if they have the sweetener in them. They're gummy. They're not very good.
I think it's because they're sort of like a one-size-fits-all type of thing, right? So if it's a company that's making a lot of, and this doesn't go for all of them, and I certainly haven't tried all of them. I'm sure that there's ones that are very good.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't use the exact same flour mix for every single item. So if there's a company that makes, say, bread and cakes and muffins, and they're using the same combination of flours or single flour for their recipes, that's why they all sort of taste the same, because there's no way that that the same ratio of ingredients as well as exact same flour mixture is going to work for, say, a yeast bread. Like in my first book, you won't see the exact same ingredients in the yeast bread as you would in a cake in the second book. And in the third book, when it comes out, same with pie crust. They all have different combinations and ratios, which are what make them what they are. But many cake mixes and stuff like that either don't have a proper combination, a proper ratio, or some of them, like the Betty Crocker one, for example, I'm pretty sure it's just rice flour and potato starch, or it's rice flour and a starch, but I don't even know how that can mimic wheat.
Okay,
that combination.
Yeah. I know what you mean. Okay, so when you make a wheat-based cake, like I said before, it's wheat flour, a baking powder, sugar, a little salt, a liquid. It could be water or milk. And then maybe whatever flavorings, vanilla. You might want a binder because in vegan baking we're not using eggs. And a lot of us have gotten accustomed to using flaxseed and water mixture,
right,
maybe
yeah.
banana, applesauce. Okay, gluten-free baking. That's where you come in.
I hope so.
You know, I don't know what your refrigerator looks like, but on my top shelf, I have 15 large jars. They're five in a row, three jars deep. What are they? They're probably like, I don't know how, they're not half gallon. Maybe they're 2 quarts. And each of them has a different powder. All-purpose gluten-free, garbanzo bean, sorghum flour, brown rice flour, tapioca starch, potato flour, buckwheat flour, and so on.
You're like your own personal grocery store in there. That's awesome.
Yeah, and I like to have backups in the freezer.
Yes, I hear you. I have lots of that.
Because with gluten-free baking, you know, the stores are getting better with supplying them, but they don't always have what you want.
And that's true, too. I know that I always get people contacting me and asking me where they can buy things or where it's cheaper to buy things or if it's safe to buy things, say, in bulk. And, I mean, as a Canadian, sometimes it's hard for me to make recommendations if someone lives in, say, the States in a very small town or city. But in the States, you guys can pretty easily order off Amazon.com,
mm-hmm.
which sounds like a plug for them, but it's really not because I wish that they'd ship to Canada, but they have amazing things that you guys can order, and that's usually a pretty easy way for people to get a hold of it. But if you're out of something and you're about to start baking, you know, you definitely want to be able to hop down to the store and get whatever you need, like whether it's sorghum flour or, you know, coconut oil or what, something easily accessible. But it can certainly, you know, you certainly have quite a large supply once you get them all in your arsenal.
But it's really not a scary thing, especially when you have a book like this to go through. So there may be 3, 4, or 5 extra ingredients.
Right, yeah.
But I just say get over it, get your hands into it, and make some really great food.
One thing I definitely try to do in the book is, and in all the books actually, is to not use too many flours. I mean, I sort of just stick to about 5 or 6 of them as a whole, as opposed to, you know, the over like 22 or so gluten-free flours that are available.
Mm-hmm.
I don't rely on, for example, in my first book, coconut flour was not really anything. No one really knew what coconut flour was when I was writing my first book. It was very hard to find and very expensive. Now it's a heck of a lot more popular, but I also know that if people are buying my first book and they're used to the flours that I sort of like to use the most, they're probably going to want those in the second book too. So I try to keep consistent with, for example, I really love sorghum flour, and sorghum flour plays a leading role in most of my recipes.
I love it too.
And you know what? It has a great taste. It's not too expensive
mm-hmm.
compared to a lot of the other gluten-free flours, and it's good for you. You know, it's full of fiber and B vitamins, and I really like that. It has a bit of natural sweetness, and it's high in fiber. Like, it's an all-around really good flour to have, and it's pretty easy to find. And if not, again, you can usually order it in. But now I'm seeing it quite often. I didn't see it that much when I started using it, and then now it's pretty much anywhere I go. It might be because everywhere I go, I say, you have to stock yourself sorghum flour. But either way, I do see it a lot more easily now, and it is a very good flour to have on hand.
I think it used to be a lot more popular decades ago, but somehow we just based ourselves on wheat, good old
yes.
wheat.
Yes, well, and that's true, too. I see a lot of very old recipes
mm-hmm.
using like sorghum grain, which
right.
I haven't even seen in person. I know that there's some companies that sell it, but again, maybe if I could visit, be near like a Whole Foods in the U.S. or something, they might have it. But I agree with you. Same with sorghum syrup. Sorghum syrup was often used instead of things like molasses in a lot of old recipes, but I don't think I've ever seen sorghum syrup on a grocery shelf.
Yeah, I haven't. Interesting. Okay, now, so aside from the basics that go into a cake, let's say, we have sorghum flour and some starches. Can you talk about what those starches are and why they're included?
I do include some starches. I try not to include too many because I want to keep the nutrition factor as well, but I do add a bit to lighten it up to give you that cake flavor or cake texture. I certainly want to make sure it tastes like cake and not like something dense and too healthy. Starches sort of play a double role in gluten-free vegan baking, and in addition to what I mentioned about lightening it up and adding the correct texture, it also helps with binding in because you're lacking what you mentioned before, you're lacking the eggs because of vegan taking the eggs out or an egg allergy. So just like, you know, when you're making pudding or something like that and you use corn or tapioca starch to thicken it, it does the same type of thing when you're baking, and then you can omit those eggs and without worrying about it crumbling as you, as you bite into it, and you don't always have to rely on something like flaxseed or something like that to keep it together. It also gives a nice texture. Tapioca flour has a bit of a chew to it, so it's nice in things that you want that stickiness, like in something like a cookie that's a little chewy on the inside. Tapioca flour does well for that.
What's really crazy these days, and I think it's more so than before, although I don't know that we have any proof of it, is there are more allergies out there everybody's talking about, and you cannot please everyone, it seems like, because people have wheat allergies, soy allergies, egg allergies, dairy allergies, or they have ethical issues to eggs and dairy. And some people have nightshade allergies, tomatoes and potatoes and corn allergies and legume allergies. Some people can't eat some beans, and then some people can't eat some nuts. It's really crazy.
Yeah, there's quite a spectrum. I often hear from people who are talking to me about various reasons why they are gluten-free, and I always hear nightshades for things like arthritis or fibromyalgia or anything related to that type of joint pain. And they always say that the two biggest things that helped them were gluten and removing gluten and nightshades. For these type of reasons, I don't include nightshades in my book. So I don't use like potato flour or potato starch, and I don't also use any legume flours like chickpea flour or fava bean flour or garfava flour. There are some in my first book, but not really in the second, or not at all in the second book, for the reason of legume allergies. There is in some recipes do call for like earth balance, you know, for that buttery flavor, because sometimes you need that buttery flavor. And that does have pea protein in it way down the line in the list of ingredients. But for people who are sensitive to these other things, I'm sensitive to knowing that. And I try to make sure that my recipes are accessible as possible without having to rely on such a mishmash of flours where they might not be able to, or they'd have to end up substituting a lot, which then they may not be successful with because of the different weights. And, you know, I want everyone to be able to enjoy them. So it's my biggest goal there. And I like how they taste, and I want people to like how they taste too.
That's very nice.
Thank you.
That's nice. Well, what's amazing to me is how many, from a kind of like a chemical background, I have a chemical engineering background, so some of this is like interesting to me, what you can substitute from one or another, just from chemistry point of view. But when you touch corn starch or potato starch or arrowroot starch, they all have very similar qualities to them. You pretty much can intermix them without much trouble.
For the most part, corn, tapioca, and arrowroot primarily. Potatoes a little iffier. It's a little heavier in its weight, so it doesn't always work out the same. But I'd say that the two that are most similar are tapioca and arrowroot starch. They're a little gummier. Like if you were to make pudding or something like that, or thickening a sauce, either way, I find that those two almost have a gummier consistency,
right.
Whereas cornstarch has more of that. When it hardens, it's more like Jello instead of, or gelatin, as opposed to the gummy stickiness that arrowroot and tapioca give. So I find that the easiest one to sub are those two, and then the other two are not quite as easy, but I mean workable for sure.
Now, you don't use rice flour?
No, there's no rice flour at all in that book.
And why do you not use rice flour?
I don't use rice flour for a few reasons. I don't like the taste of it. I think that it has a very distinct taste to it, and I can taste it when I eat other products or if I'm somewhere that bakes with it. I also think that the texture itself, so like that's more like flavor, but I also think the texture is not much to be desired. And, it just sort of lacks nutrition. Like it's compared to all the other ones, it just sort of falls short, and I would rather use something that has more nutrition and a little bit more wholesomeness to it, just like I wouldn't use all-purpose white flour if I wasn't celiac. I similarly am not going to use white rice flour because of that reason. And brown rice flour, again, it's a little heavier. It gives a bit of a denser consistency, and I just I don't think that compared to mixing the other flours together that it does quite as well and making something taste just like the real thing, which is my ultimate goal always. I don't want it to taste like a substitute or this is a pretty good cake for, you know, gluten-free or for vegan. I want it to taste exactly or better than you remember. And I don't think rice flour can do that job successfully.
Right. Well, semantic-wise, I don't want to say like the real thing. I think tasting like you remember and better is a better way to put it, because they're all real.
Right,
it's just
yes,
we've,
that's true.
We've been socialized in some way to certain ingredients, and it's incredible. You know, we all think we have a certain degree of free choice, but so much of it is just what business has made available for us.
That's true as well, and you know, it's what we're accustomed to when we're growing up, and I think that I suppose then tasting like I remember things is much is a much better way to put it, because if I think of, say, you know, my grandmother's pierogi from when I was a child, the real thing certainly doesn't taste like what she would make was the real thing to me, but what you buy in the grocery store was certainly not tasting like the real thing. And those are both made with wheat. So, you know, my goal, I guess, is always tasting like you remember or even better. Maybe, actually, just even better.
Okay, now, little silly question. The picture of the woman on the cover.
I get that a lot.
Is that you?
No, it's not. A lot of people ask me when they see me in real life, they're like, oh.
You don't look like the person in the picture. Who is that?
You know what? She's just the face of the allergy-free cook. She does the job for me.
Okay. Well, all right. I just had to know that. And I don't know, we have about a minute or two left, but I wanted to comment that in the beginning of the book, you really go all out explaining so many different things. If people want to substitute oil for butter or margarine, or substituting or how different flours will work, and there's really a lot of research that went in here.
I definitely try to make it really accessible to everyone. So if, for example, you have an intolerance to another flour or you just really don't have access to it, like I have a friend who lives in the UK that can't find sorghum flour for the life of her.
Mm.
So, you know, and those using those tips, she's been able to make, more than 25 recipes from both books combined because of what she knows would sub well using those ingredients. So that's why I try to do it. Just, I mean, obviously everything is, you know, is the ultimate to be made as written, but it also makes it much more accessible to have a very close version if you don't have access to everything or can't have it from an allergy or whatever reason.
Well, thank you.
Thank you,
Lori Sadowski, for this book, The Allergy-Free Cook Bakes Cakes and Cookies. It's really a good one. And I can't wait to dig in and start making some of these recipes because they look really great.
I'm excited to hear how it goes.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining me, and it's all about food. And have a very sweet day and a sweet year, and good luck with this book.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I'm Karen Hartgloss, and you know, this is It's All About Food, and we will be back in a few minutes, and we're going to be talking about vegetarian boxing with Omawale Whale Adwell. We'll be right back.